in North Charleston.
One man shot in the back running, another nine more shot in the church across the street. So 10 blacks are dead, two white men in jail. And we do not know what the outcome would be in a judicial sense. We know the result is in that these men are dead and we know who killed them. But the question of what would be done concretely beyond using these two guys as posters to represent the culture. The culture is much deeper and much wider than two men. Much deeper and much wider than two men.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson standing in front of Mother Emanuel Church as thousands pay their last respects to South Carolina State Senator and the Reverend Clementa Pinckney. Today, the funeral for Reverend Pinckney. Thousands are lining up to attend. That does it for our broadcast. Special thanks to the Sustainability Institute here in Charleston and to our local crew, Robbie Bischoff, Nick Townsend, Rafael Rivera, Doug Kelly, and Garland Irvin. And to our crew here who came down to Charleston with me, to Amy Littlefield and Dennis Moynihan, to John Hamilton. Thank you so much to Julie Crosby and Sam Alkoff and Aaron Mate. We have two job openings at Democracy Now! Check our website. Thank you to Renee Feltz and to Elizabeth Press. And to all the folks at Democracy Now!, Nermeen Sheikh and Dina Guzder, who made this broadcast possible. Our website's democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from Charleston, South Carolina. I'm Amy Goodman.
And it's a half a minute past 8 a.m. on KBOO Portland. Coming up immediately is Positively Revolting Talk Radio with hosts Ani and Lynn. Today they will have a guest in the studio, Dr. Guy McPherson, and they will be talking about the likelihood of near-term human extinction. So you'll want to stay tuned for that.
Attention KBOO members and listeners. The KBOO Foundation is seeking to fill four upcoming vacancies on the Board of Directors. Terms run 3 years, beginning on October 1st. The nomination packet, due July 11th, is posted on the KBOO website and paper copies are available at the station. Candidates must submit the completed nomination packet via email to kboocommunity@gmail.com or mail or drop off the completed nomination packet, care of Timothy Welp, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Incomplete forms will not be considered as fulfilling the statement of interest requirement by the KBOO bylaws. Packets are due by Saturday, July 11th. The candidate statements submitted as part of the nomination packet will be posted to KBOO's website, and candidates will be expected to participate in an interview for broadcast and a Q&A session at the annual meeting. For more information, please contact the nominating committee at kboocommunity@gmail.com.
And whatever hood you represent, I know it's a lot of bad out there, but guess what? It's a lot of good too.
It's that time again. Time for another three-day community festival at Good in the Hood 2015, which is sure to bring even more than before. Starting June 26th through June 28th at Lil's Albina Park, there will be a celebration of community with live music, kids space, lots of local foods, and a chance for health screening too. KBOO is also in the Good in the Hood parade, and we want our members and volunteers to participate. For more information, contact Ani Haynes at volunteer@kboo.org. Again, Good in the Hood, Friday, June 26th through Sunday, June 28th. And KBOO will be broadcasting live on Saturday, June 27th. See you in the hood.
I know it's a lot of bad out there, but guess what?
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Underground Grad School Series, Portland's Urban Native Americans, What You Need to Know to Be an Ally. Classes will start July 8th and continuing for 4 weeks on Wednesdays at 7 at Southeast Uplift in Portland. Classes will focus on issues such as federal policy toward Native peoples, inequities Portland's Native peoples face, blood quantum, and more. It will also address contemporary ideas of privilege, white fragility, and the complexities of intersectionality. Again, that's Portland's Urban Native Americans, What You Need to Know to Be an Ally, Wednesdays at 7 p.m. at Southeast Uplift, 3534 Southeast Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Good morning, good morning. It is 5 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, and you are tuned to your very own community radio station, KBOO Portland, 90.7 on the FM dial.
Yep, still is.
Or perhaps KBOO.FM online. And this is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And here we are together again every Friday morning, 8 to 9 o'clock. This morning, we are returning to our discussion of deep ecology, climate change, and how humans as a species are dealing with the fact that we are in a mass extinction period. With us this morning is Guy McPherson. Guy is a professor emeritus of natural resources and the environment at University of Arizona, where he taught and conducted research for 20 award-winning years. His scholarly work has for many years focused on conservation of biological diversity, and he's produced a dozen books and hundreds of articles. He lives in an off-grid straw bale house where he puts into practice his lifelong interest in sustainable living by fully engaging with his rural human community. Because the topics of his presentations sometimes induce despair, Guy became a certified grief recovery specialist in last year. That certification came from the Grief Recovery Institute. Hey, good morning, Guy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Ani. It's a pleasure to be with you and Lynn today.
It's, the topic is heavy. We return to this topic with some frequency because, in fact, it is one of the most important topic that we are facing as a species, as a planet. We have the good fortune of having talked to Molly Brown and Barbara Ford, who are both contemporaries, colleagues of Joanna Macy. And we've been talking about deep ecology and sort of the agony, really, of being aware of the state of our planet. And in those discussions, you kind of always get to this edge where we look at the damage, we look at the devastation that is going on, that is continuing, that is accelerating. And there's that uncomfortable place where you think, maybe we can't really fix this. Whoops. If you've been tracking like I've been tracking my life, I was a great fan of Dr. Helen Caldicott's. I still am. And I remember in the early 90s, she said that we had about, really at that point, about a 30% chance of making it for another decade. And that's without the advent of nuclear war. And so then we made it that extra decade. And in the early aughts, I remembered that speech, and I went back and I read the writings that speech came from. And I, okay, all right, we made it this far. But really, no pun intended, we're skating on thin ice, right? And every year I'm just like, oh, we crossed that Rubicon too. So, Guy,
now that we've crossed many Rubicons, now that we've said, oh, it's okay, we can still handle it because we still have this thing. And then example after example of that thing not really being there anymore. Or not yet. Or, you know, how do we assimilate the information that, in fact, all of those points of no return, we've been passing them with great speed?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the whole story right there. I started hearing when I was a wee grandchild that environmental problems were going to have to be solved by the grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And we get the same story every day from the mainstream that we have all these problems, and by 2100, we're going to have to figure them out. You know, it wasn't that long ago that it was by 2000 we had to figure them out. And the hits keep coming, everything's getting worse. But because we have solar panels and amazing digital devices, I keep hearing that we're going to get this figured out.
Paint your roofs white.
There you go. White roofs and solar panels.
And that is the thing. You
have to because, how do... Go ahead. Is that what you want to say? How do we...
I was going to say something else, probably. Okay. Go ahead. No, after you.
Yeah. Lately, in particular, there's been a tsunami, if you will, of reports saying, this is it, folks. And yet, I think, as a kid, I was raised on... The universe will come to an end a few million years from now when the sun collides with the blah, blah, blah. And that's sort of in my consciousness as a thing that it's always going to be in the future somewhere. And now, as the Fire Sign Theater used to say, the future is here. The future is fair. You may already have won. You may already be there. So how do people, you know, how are you dealing with that? How do you see folks besides, there's a lot of denial.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot
and
of...
who could blame folks?
Right. A couple of things come to mind. We've heard for more than a quarter of a century from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that we're going to have to start reducing emissions.
One of these here days.
More than a quarter of a century, we've been hearing that that's the central issue and we're going to have to address this. And, of course, we haven't. And we get the same information from them every single assessment. Mm-hmm. We need to start reducing emissions, and we don't, and we won't until it's absolutely forced upon us. So, of course, we're here. Of course, we're in this state. So, how do people deal with it? I see all of the stages, although Elizabeth Kubler-Ross preferred them not to be called stages or discrete points. I see all those behaviors, all those actions, right? Denial and anger and bargaining and depression and acceptance. And then I spend quite a bit of my time in the sixth stage of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief that goes beyond acceptance and into gallows humor. Uh-huh. And I see that in some people. And, of course, we all go back and forth. It's not like we spend all of our time in one of those states.
Well, and people during the plague, the Black Plague, apparently people went out and danced. There were plague dances where people just went, oh, well... Let's dance.
Right.
You know, at some point, so there's about 3,000 ways I want to go with this conversation. First of all, I want to let you know it is, of course, talk radio. And we invite your calls at 503-231-8187. You can also always follow us along on Facebook, Positively Revolting, or on Twitter, at Positive Revolt. I guess there's the crux for me. One of the points is in talking to folks about, you know, things are really, really dire, and I don't think we're really pulling out of this. And, you know, it's like, I get accused of being a real bummer sometimes. And yet, so the question almost always comes back to me, so why are you doing anything? Why aren't you just, you know, sitting on the beach and drinking, you know, Mai Tais until the end comes?
Right, and so every day I think I should quit my current so-called career as a writer and speaker and trying to get the information out. Because if you don't get it by now, you really haven't been paying attention. And I don't think I'm having that big an impact. But at my core, I'm a teacher. It's not what I do, it's who I am. Obviously, I tried to not do that for a while and it tore me apart. So I had to re-engage. In addition, I think there's nobody else connecting the dots. on this most pivotal of issues. There's nobody else pointing out that we've crossed so many Rubicons, there's no going back. And I think almost everybody else I know in the climate science community is earning a paycheck for telling people it's not going to be so bad. And it is. It is horribly, terribly bad. I think those people are guilty of malpractice, and I think people deserve to know what I know, which is the evidence I present.
You talk about art being and going dark, and it could have, I love that you had your science students do art projects, and they hated it until they loved it.
Right.
That, you know, there's the bumper sticker, art saves lives, and but it does save sanity, and it's of course becoming more of a commodity in this culture. But so how do you feel about, tell us your feelings about how art will help us live through till we are not living through.
Yeah, you know, in this culture we commodify everything, so yeah. Big surprise.
Right.
In fact, it was the CIA that made Jackson Pollock a household name. Most people don't know that, but they have their fingers in everything.
Now that one I don't know.
I didn't know that. Thank you very much.
Oh yeah, you know, it was at a time when we were trying, when this country was trying to distinguish itself from those nasty socialists in Russia.
The commies, okay.
The commies, right? And so yet another way to do that is to demonstrate our sophistication. Oh, look, we're so sophisticated, we think this is art, right? So so we throw paint on a canvas. Look, this, we're so sophisticated, we aren't doing that old-fashioned stuff anymore. And so the CIA actually, I mean, they just have their fingers in everything, and they turned Jackson Pollock into a household name and a bajillionaire because that made us cooler than the Ruskies.
All right, CIA behind modern art movement.
Didn't make Jackson Pollock a happier person, though, did it?
Well, you know, what would.
Mistakes have been made.
Let's go ahead.
And I'm sorry. Art. Yes.
Art.
For the last 10 years or so, I was at the University of Arizona. I had my students in, you know, I was teaching strictly science classes. I had each of them prepare a significant piece of art or literature as a major part of their grade. And of course, they hated it. You know, from day one, they would resist horribly. This is not science. And I would have colleagues come in and do guest lectures. And one of them, I remember clearly, a close friend and colleague of mine at the time, and he came in and said, if you're doing finger painting, you're not doing conservation biology. That is not science. And, you know, that's a third of the way into the semester. So I got to make fun of him every day for the rest of the semester. It's not like he had the last word. What the hell was he thinking? So it was a little weird. Anyway, you know, Plato was writing a long time ago, and then C.P. Snow with his 1959 essay, Two Cultures, and then Edward O. Wilson with his 1995 book, Consilience. All of these are pointing towards, and Francis Bacon, 1600, with Novum Organum, they're pointing out that integration of the humanities and the natural sciences actually makes for a more complete person with more complete experiences, and it applies at the level of society as well. And we keep ignoring those voices, the wise ones that would have us lead whole lives, because leading whole lives takes you off the hamster wheel. It forces you to no longer compartmentalize everything you do and commodify everything you do. And so my students hated it, of course, for the first 15 weeks of the semester. And then we would get together, usually the last class period, and we would share with each other the art. And they would leave and they would say, it's the best experience I've ever had in college. Everybody should be required to do this in every single class. And I'm like, where the hell you been for 15 weeks?
Well, or thank you for thank you for getting it.
However that works. Let's go ahead and talk to Sean, who's called us. Good morning, Sean. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for the topic today.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
It seems like there's kind of a mantra on the left. It must have been about a month ago. I was listening to Abe and Joe. And the topic of environment came up, and this mantra gets repeated over and over again that, you know, free market capitalism is toxic to the earth, which is obvious. But then what always gets repeated over and over is that, well, the Soviet Union was terrible on the environment as well. And it really struck me because it was right around the time of the 70th anniversary of the fall of Berlin. I think the Soviet Union lost something like 20 million, or somewhere around 500,000 men just taking Berlin alone. The U.S. didn't even lose that much in the entire war. And so I guess the reason I'm calling this morning is that we have to get back to this notion of rationing. there's, you know, this fetishization of decentralization, of small is better. It seems like, you know, when we have phytoplankton disappearing as a result of ocean acidification, to me that calls for massive economic planning and centralization, that you can't have a free market consumer-based society when something like that is taking place. You have to plan your economy to stop something like that. And yet people continue to bash the old Soviet Union and bash communism when we really need to get back to central planning and get away from this fetishization of small is better and decentralization.
All right. Thanks very much for your call, Sean. What do you say, Guy?
As pointed out quite clearly in the Referee Journal literature, civilization is a heat engine. If we're going to stop heating the planet, we need to turn off civilization. We don't need a massive plan of any kind to fix anything. That's what got us into this mess, is massive plans to fix things. For every solution, there are myriad problems that arise. And we've been applying solutions for a long time at a large scale, and it's an unmitigated disaster.
And I think that, you know, for myself, I like communism. Okay, I'll say it. I like communism a whole lot. I like socialism a whole lot. I think there are good points about these planned economies. I think neither of them offer any kind of solutions for environmental devastation. That, I agree. It's civilism. I think it was Ralph Waldo Emerson that said that human beings would eventually die of civilization. And true.
Yeah, and, right? And here we are.
You're right.
Civilization carries us to the brink. There's no ism that's going to work because we've triggered those self-reinforcing feedback loops on the climate front. And if there were an ism a long time ago that would have worked, it, in my opinion, it would be anarchism, because that's what we did for 2.8 million years of the genus Homo on the planet, is anarchism, tribalism.
Exactly.
And it's pretty obvious that through history, we are barely able to control our own lives, much less the lives of others. And so capitulating to city council members and members of Congress and on and on and on just seems like a really bad idea. And we keep doing it. Any ism in a shitstorm, I guess.
Is that, I would love our listeners to know, what is a feedback loop? Just for folks that don't know, because that was mentioned a lot in your book, and
right.
And I like to clarify things.
Yeah, self-reinforcing feedback loops, or so-called positive feedbacks, although they aren't positive for us, are these phenomena that feed upon themselves. It's the snake eating its own tail. At some level, it's the rock you throw over the cliff, at least the beginning. And so the faster it goes, the more ground it covers, and the faster it's able to go as a result. So a good example from the climate change literature is Arctic ice. As Arctic ice declines in cover and volume, it's less able to cool the Arctic Ocean, and there's less reflectance coming off of that white ice and more absorption by the blue water. And so the faster the ice melts, the warmer it gets, the faster it melts.
Right, right. And you also talk about the northern hemisphere as being the place that's going to be uninhabitable. Is that because of the damage in the Arctic?
Several reasons. The Arctic, which is where much of the methane is coming from.
I was going to say, we talk about car emissions, but right now things are starting to come up from the earth and in your book you were talking about even in the ocean is bubbling up methane.
That's right. NASA's CARve project reported, based on satellite observations, direct observations in July 2013, there were methane plumes coming out of the Arctic Ocean up to 150 kilometers across. So I think there are several reasons the northern hemisphere is doomed with respect to habitat for humans before the southern hemisphere. Foremost among them, that continental regions heat up faster than the global average. And essentially all the land on the planet is in the northern hemisphere. So you think of places that...
There's, a fair concentration. I mean, definitely the vast majority of land.
Yeah, there's a third of Africa, South America, and that little island known as Australia. Those are the ones in the southern hemisphere. It pales in comparison to Europe, Asia, North America, and so on. Mm-hmm. In addition, there's a little bit of ice in the Arctic, but there's a lot of ice in the Antarctic. And then finally, four of the world's 447 nuclear power facilities are in the Southern Hemisphere.
Right.
The rest are in the Northern Hemisphere.
Right. Yes, I was going to get to that at some point.
Because we just keep having more fun, so let's keep going a little deeper.
Well, it is always astonishing me that the denial people have about, and we cover this all the time on KBOO, about Fukushima, about the disaster of that. Starfish have disappeared from... I was talking to some people at the coast about that, and they're like, "Oh, it was a, and it could have been a virus that happened because the waters are warmer." But I mean, I said, "Do you think it had anything to do with radiation coming over here?" "Oh, no, 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 no." I know people that are still taking their kids on field trips to Japan. It's because a scientist came in and told the school it was going to be okay. I am continually just floored at the denial of how you know, radiation is the key gift that keeps on giving.
Absolutely.
For heaven's sakes. And so you mentioned that one of our one of the keys of the destruction is, of course, nuclear power plants. Fukushima is a good start because there is nothing being done about that.
Right. It's a hell of a way to boil water, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It sure
rather
is.
Extreme.
Rather than pointing fingers and trying to figure out which particular aspect of civilization is killing the starfish, let's go all the way to the root and admit that it's industrial civilization that's killing the starfish. Whether it's manifest through nuclear power or a virus resulting from a warming ocean or non-native species that we transport around and dump in places that they never belong, so there's adverse interaction between species. All of those are rooted ultimately in industrial civilization. That's the root of our many, many, many predicaments. And all this finger pointing seems like a distraction to me. Seems like a sideshow. Oh no, it's the black people in the South that are causing the problem. Oh no, it's the yellow people in the West who are causing our civilization to collapse. Let's point our fingers at them. This is all, and when it comes to industrial civilization, it's the same sort of thing. Which symptom do you want to point out as the problem? Is the game that's being played?
Yeah, can't argue with that.
Radio. Let's talk to James, shall we? Good morning, James. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I had to call in and respond to that first caller. I'm a strong advocate for decentralization. I believe that the centralized economies enable imperialists to drag the people into war, and that is the main problem. And it's also the reason this industrial society, this monopoly capitalist tyrannical system that we live under is a direct result of going towards centralized planning. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, James. So, Guy, do you find a lot when you start talking about these issues that people want to talk about topics that really they want to relate but aren't? You know, it's like, don't look over there. That is too scary. Let's talk about this other thing instead. Because we have found that, actually, doing Positively Revolting here, when we start getting to the really kind of deep and really kind of scarier topics, people want to look over there. Look, squirrel.
Sure.
Let's really debate communism versus capitalism right now, because that's going to help us.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's what we do. That's what this culture drives us to do. Instead of getting to the root, becoming a radical, we spend a lot of time focused on these distractions. And, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, all the mainstream media outlets, they're contributing to this ongoing lack of conversation that's meaningful. It's, we have the attention span of gnats at this point, and that's being enabled as a self-reinforcing feedback loop by the media. Squirrel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's talk to Michael. 503-231-8187, the number to call. You are listening to Positively Revolting.
Yes, you are.
I'm Ani. I'm here
Lynn.
With Lynn. And our guest this morning is Guy McPherson. And let's go ahead and talk to Michael now. Good morning.
Good morning. I teach computer science at a local community college, and your idea about having science students do art intrigued me, but I've been trying to think, what would I do that would be art in a computer science class? And I just have absolutely no clue what I could possibly do, and I just was curious if you had some reasonably good idea about even where to start thinking about it, or a good idea about what they could do or anything like that?
Sure, I would start by thinking outside of the computer science class. In my courses had various titles: fire ecology, conservation biology, wildland vegetation management, all kinds of different titles. And I would ask the students to create a piece of art or literature, and I didn't put any constraints. In fact, they would often ask for examples. What do you mean by that? Because they've been so constrained by this culture for so long that it's difficult for them to think of anything that might be relevant. And I wouldn't give examples because I didn't want to constrain their creativity. And at one point, I said, I really don't care if you do interpretive dance. And I didn't think much of it. It was a throwaway line. It was something of a joke. And then 3 or 4 years later, when I was no longer allowed to teach that class, a colleague of mine was teaching it with the same syllabus I had created, and a woman did interpretive dance. And it brought tears to the eyes of half the people there. It was absolutely astonishing. So in my case, and I suspect in your case, you would be best served by not putting constraints on it. It doesn't have to be within the context of computer science to contribute to making them a whole person and therefore a better computer scientist.
Wow. Well, I don't know if I'm brave enough to do that, but it's definitely food for thought.
You know, when I first started, I was terrified, and the first time I did it, I did not invite anybody from the public. And so it was just a class of 38 students and me, and we were sharing it with each other. And by the time I was done, I was kicking myself because I didn't invite the public, because it was the most amazing display of integrated humanity I'd witnessed in my entire life. And from then on, my colleague made it a public event when he taught that class, conservation biology.
What was the name
biology.
Of that class?
It was called conservation biology. It was not required for any major on campus. There were 38 students representing 25 different majors on campus, ranging from creative writing to the hardcore biology students. And so there already was this vibe, if we just let it go, of multidisciplinarity present in the classroom. But, you know, the same applied when I taught courses like wildland vegetation management, required only by 3 or 4 majors on the whole campus. So these people actually did see eye to eye and had been in the same silo for a long time. We just need to kick down the silos. And yes, it requires a little bit of bravery so that you can, you know, academia is not really very good, does not give rewards for people breaking out of their silos. But we're in the end times, man. If you can't throw off the shackles of culture now, when can you?
Excellent question. Thanks very much for your call, Michael.
So, Guy, you talk a lot. You have a lot to say about hope in your books.
I do.
The audacity of hope.
Yes. Yes.
And I've heard Jerick Jensen talk about it too, and I've always found that very intriguing, and I like it. But please expound.
Yeah. Hope, from Derek Jensen's perspective, hope is wishing for an outcome over which one has no agency. And that matches at least one of the definitions in the dictionary. I'm with Nietzsche on this one. Hope, in reality, is the worst of evils, for it extends the torments of man. And had he not been such a misogynist, he might have included women in there, too. A little hard to say. I think, and only because I was invited to participate in a retreat at a Dharma center, at a Buddhist Dharma center in Winnipeg in February of last year, did I finally begin to gain some understanding of a Buddhist perspective, a philosophical perspective, not the religious perspective. Mm-hmm. And among those is that hope and fear are the twin sides of the I don't know the future coin. So we hope the future is going to look like this, or we fear that the future is going to look like that. And we cause that to affect our daily actions. That's insane. We can't predict the future with great accuracy, with great precision. We don't know what the future holds for the world, much less for us as individuals. And so instead of hoping or fearing, let's live here now. Let's take right actions and not be attached to the outcome of those actions. Because at this point, I don't see even a bunch of right actions. I don't see a return to anarchism being a plausible way to deal with the absolute mess we're in on myriad fronts. So we're screwed. Yeah. So live here now, and let's take right action. And I'm not a Buddhist, and I barely even know what that means. But there are certain principles of Buddhism to which I subscribe.
Well, and that whole not being attached to the outcome is the hardest thing for Western civilization.
Absolutely, especially for the people who look a lot like me. For middle-aged white guys who have always been pulling the levers of industry, we're stuck in a rut. It's hard to see out of that rut. It's difficult to imagine that anything could possibly go wrong if we just keep pulling the levers.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's really difficult to let go of the notion of attachment. Let go or be dragged.
You are listening to Positively Revolting on KABU. This is a talk show. You calls are welcomed at 503-231-8187. Also want to encourage you to check us out on Facebook, where you can find us as Positively Revolting, or follow us on Twitter at Positive Revolt. I have to say, we have achieved my favorite number. We have 555 people liking our Facebook page.
Mine says 54.
Oh, okay. Check that out.
That's one more, funny. Quick.
Right.
Huh. That's really hilarious. Well, maybe you tuned
different.
Into it after me or something.
I don't know. 555 on mine.
All right.
I don't know, Lynn.
Works for me.
That's interesting. My favorite number is 666. Maybe we're coming from a different perspective.
I think, but similarly inclined. Yeah. Anyways, we've been talking sort of around the issue of well, you know, things are happening. Things, we've crossed Rubicons, we've crossed lines, we've gone past points of no return. Let's talk a little bit about timelines, because I think too many of us, again, you know, okay, I grew up under Reagan, right? I'll be 49 next month. I never actually expected to see 20, because when I was, I think it was my 15th birthday, that somewhere in that month, there were nuclear submarines off the coast of Puget Sound, and we were at 2 minutes to midnight, and I was pretty sure, you know, that we were all going to die in some sort of fiery disaster imminently. Through some miracles, we didn't. And I've always sort of figured, you know, any time past my 16th birthday has been a gift, you know. So living in the world about to end, I don't want to say it's like second nature, but it's not new to me, because I've been aware of the incredible dangers that have been existent in our world that we've created.
You missed hiding the nuclear when I was a kid with the nuclear.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't have to dive under my desk.
Getting under the desk to help you from the nuclear bomb. Yes.
Yeah. No, I didn't have to do that. Okay. But, you know,
You could afford desks at your schools?
This was a long time ago.
She was fancy.
This was a long time ago when people just passed school bonds and actually put money into school.
But we're up
the olden days.
Is, you know, in this range, we're always like, well, you know, yeah, we're all going to die someday. It's true. But from your perspective and the research that you have been a part of, can you give us a little bit on timelines? Because, again, you're looking at things that are saying kind of imminently.
Yeah, you know, predictions are tough, especially about the future. So I rely on the science conducted by other people. So, for example, as one example, if civilization collapses this year, or even if it doesn't, we could have an ice-free Arctic. We could. I'm not making a prediction here. It looks like we're headed that direction.
It certainly does.
But if we have an ice-free Arctic, then it could very well be that the first 50 gigaton burst of methane field researcher Natalia Shukova warns about as being, quote, highly possible at any time. It could be that first 50 gigaton burst of methane emerges from the Arctic Ocean. And that will produce at least a 1.3 Celsius global average temperature rise. And now it takes about a year for the methane to circle the globe faster in the northern hemisphere. And so that 1.3 is sufficient to cause collapse of civilization, because civilization requires grains, which are grown in the interior of large continents. That means we're up over 4 degrees in the interior, and so you can't grow corn and wheat anymore.
Paleo diet's looking better and better than
absolutely. So when industrial civilization fails, we lose the global dimming associated with the particles that we put up there into the atmosphere. It's a really damned if you do and damned if you don't situation. As a result of industrialization, we're putting a bunch of stuff into the atmosphere that's causing a warming, right? Causing the warming to be held onto the Earth. We're putting up these big blankets known as carbon dioxide and methane and ozone and right. chlorofluorocarbons and so on. But at the same time, the particles we put up there, most notably sulfates associated with poor quality coal, are serving as an umbrella. And those sulfates are falling out every day, all day. We put them up there every day, all day. And if we stop, they all fall out in 3 or 4 days. And then we experience a dramatic spike in global average temperature, at least 1.4 degrees. So the combination of those two leads to the great potential for human extinction, or at least loss of habitat for humans, within about 18 months from now. So it could be that it happens that fast. We would reach a temperature we've never observed as humans before, with more than 3/4 of that heating coming in a span of a few months. Already, the ability of plants and animals to keep up with the slow rate of climate change we've experienced so far lags by 10,000 times. So we've warmed a little less than 1 degree Celsius since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. That's 10,000 times faster than native organisms can keep up with adaptation. Well, we sort of need those organisms if we're going to survive, you know, because we eat stuff, not just human stuff. So as long as we're not eating humans, we're eating plant material. And so we need those plants to survive. Ana, you mentioned the phytoplankton earlier in the ocean. The base of the marine food web, phytoplankton, is responsible for about half the food humans eat. Mm-hmm. Ocean acidification is driving the phytoplankton to extinction. And the same applies for land plants. You know, we get a big drought someplace, you can't grow plants. We get fires that, like this planet has never seen, and on the list goes. So scientists used to say that 4 degrees Celsius is too much, that humans won't survive that. And I think that's pretty conservative, considering on this planet we've never experienced 3.3 degrees Celsius above baseline, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and had humans on it. So 4C, especially over a relatively short period of time, suggests to me that the organisms we depend upon for our lives are not going to be there. So that means no food. So the goalpost keeps moving back now that 4 degrees is locked in for sure, as reported most recently by Shell Oil Company.
Totally noticed how the goalpost keeps moving back.
Yeah. So now it's not 4C that'll kill us all, even though that was the consensus in 2008, 2009.
No, wait. It's
It must be some bigger number. We don't know what the number is, but it's bigger than that.
But it's really bigger.
Let's invite Quincy into this conversation,
Quincy,
shall we?
What have you to say?
Good morning, Quincy.
Hello?
Hello, Quincy.
Hey, how's it going?
Are you in your car?
Yes.
Are you stopped? Have you stopped?
I have headphones in.
Okay, all right. Carry on, Quincy. We're just looking out for you and everyone else.
Thank you so much. I guess I had one original thing, but now I heard you guys say something, so I wanted to add something. Computer science guy that called and was wondering how he could do art with his computer science students. I'm an art teacher as well, and I recently saw this woman named Natalie Jeremenko or something like that. She's from New York. She did a cool thing with computers and stuff, and she put these sensors on clams or mussels, like in like the New York Harbor or something there on the Hudson. And then every time they closed, she linked the sensors to some musical notes. And so like when there's too much toxicity in the water, like the mussels will close, and then it would make a musical note. She did this cool project where it was like, you know, they were closing and opening and making these musical sounds, and it was showing like every time they close, it's because the water's poisoned. So that's something cool you can do with computers and art in a way.
Art at the end of the world with computers.
A symphony of poisoned crustaceans.
I guess my original question had to do with what you guys were just recently talking about, actually, global average temperature. Mm-hmm. I was curious how global average temperature is calculated with, like, all the variation of the different climate zones and heights and elevations on planet Earth. I was just curious, like, how do you get the average temperature of, like, the globe when...
Seems a fine question for a professor emeritus. How does that happen?
That is a good question, and it's... You know, in the early days of climate science, the sensors were not so good, and almost all the sensors, after all, for measuring temperature directly are on land, because that's where you find most of the humans. And so there were issues with determining that number early on. For example, almost all the thermometers are in cities. And then climate scientists figure out, oh, there's an urban heat island effect that causes especially the winter nights, to not get as cold in the city as they do in the country. So there's this artificial impact of having thermometers in the cities that isn't really reflecting reality. Well, since then, there's a whole bunch of technology that has been developed, you know, weather balloons that get up above the surface, and so they aren't impacted by being close to the surface. We know about the urban heat island effect. You know, scientists are not completely stupid all the time. And so we've come to recognize these various biases. And it's been 2 decades now since scientists have started removing those biases through a variety of means that allow us to get a global average temperature reading that takes into account the oceans, you know, 3/4 of the surface of the Earth that for 200 years nobody thought of sticking a thermometer in. Right. And we also use proxy records, tree rings and ice cores. And so it's a very, very much more sophisticated task than I could possibly explain in the remaining 20 minutes. But the bottom line is the climate scientists sort of have this one figured out and have taken into account multiple biases that are still brought up by the deniers every single time, by the climate skeptics every single time. Oh, all the thermometers are in the city. No, they're actually not. You know, and we figured out how to deal with that bias early on, and we've moved on, but the skeptics have not moved on. So bottom line is you can do your quick little online search and figure out that we've been taking into account all those adverse impacts for quite a long time. And so we know with considerable certainty that the global average temperature was about 12.5 degrees centigrade when we started this whole show, known as civilization.
Right.
And that the stable points in the past have been Jurassic Park, about 22 degrees centigrade, and a couple of waypoints in between that aren't particularly long-lasting or common. And where we're at now is not one. So we're in this transition from Ice Age to Jurassic Park, and clearly we're going up, and we know how to adjust for a bunch of those things that bothered us for a long time.
All right. Does that answer your question?
He's gone.
He's good.
He switched to his fax machine. He's got a fax machine in his car.
It's amazing. Technology's amazing.
Let's go now to Matt. Good morning, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for joining us.
I also had a follow-up comment for the computer scientist. Fractals are actually the one of the most simple, I guess, computer, like it would just be contained on the computer that you could do. Also, I mean, we did some basic animation stuff with Apple Basic back in 97, so those types of things are available. And that's all I have. Thanks for being here.
Okay. Matt, thanks for hanging out for the teaching tip.
That's a good point, and I want to point out that it goes the other way, too. You know, it's not just scientists who should be introducing the arts into their courses. It's the artists who should be introducing the sciences into their courses. And yes, it's going to be uncomfortable, as it was for me. Yeah. I'm no artist, right? But I'm expecting the students to be artists.
Right.
And so that pushes my intellectual boundaries as well as my psychological boundaries. Well, if you're an art teacher, learn a little bit of science.
Well, and actually, I mean, I think that bringing the two together, it's symbolic of a sort of holistic view. And it's beyond symbolic. It is actually bringing together a more sort of holistic way of being in this world, appreciating the absolute sensual nature, meaning that nature enjoyed or at least enjoined in the senses, that art is so good at hitting. And science, you know, in that understanding, in that, in our cleverness, in our way of wanting to dissect and figure out how, you know, mm-hmm. these are wonderful together. And frankly, science without art is kind of bleak and maybe a little dangerous. Mm-hmm.
and art without science seems to be not particularly rooted in reality.
Right,
Right. So there you have it.
Bring them together, kids. All right, let's go ahead and talk to Eric. Good morning. You're on the air, Eric.
Thank you. Really appreciate your conversation, Mr. McPherson. It seems like there's been some change in the conversation to global climate change, and I guess I just want to add this in, because the certainties out there, nothing is certain, because we're not given enough information to even make any certainties. I'm sitting here this morning, and I'm looking at the chemtrailing that's going on that everybody doesn't want to look up in the sky and admit to. It's obvious this is some type of planned situation, isn't just commercial airlines going by. Or we've got HAARP, H-A-A-R-P. If you could just discuss this, Mr. McPherson, because it concerns me so much that we're getting so little information as to what really is happening to our planet.
All right. Thanks very much, Eric.
Thank you for the question, Eric. I tend to focus my efforts on reality, not on poorly supported ideas. HAARP was an experiment conducted by the federal government, and it failed. So we're not doing HAARP anymore. And there is no support for the notion of purposeful addition of particulates through chemtrails. If you want to read the science on that, I would recommend you go to contrailscience.com. Contrails. These are condensation trails. They're not particulates being put out by people to kill us all or to make us live longer.
So you don't think that they're doing geoengineering at this time?
I think we've been doing geoengineering since we used the first plow. I think we've been doing geoengineering since we fired up the first internal combustion engine. I think geoengineering is a reality. I think solar radiation management is not going on, in part because the people who actually know about solar radiation management know that planes don't fly high enough to put the particulates into the stratosphere. So that's, again, an idea rooted in ignorance, that we can spray particulates into the atmosphere at 30,000 feet and it would actually serve to cool the planet. There's no evidence to support that idea. You aren't nearly high enough, and planes can't fly nearly high enough.
So you're not saying that there's any... You're not a believer in chemtrails, then?
There's no evidence to support the notion of chemtrails.
I don't think it's a belief that he's talking about. He's talking about evidence, scientific evidence rather than belief.
Right.
Well, what am I seeing then? What am I seeing going across the sky in no particular pattern, not consistent with commercial airline flights? I don't understand what I'm seeing then, Mr. McPherson.
I would recommend you go to contrailscience.com for a full dismantling of the notion of chemtrails.
All right. Thank you very much, Eric, for your call this morning. I think that, again, there's a lot of there's a huge amount of concern, right? People know that things are wrong. And we know the government lies to us. We know the media does not talk about important stuff. We know that there's a huge distraction campaigns. And so those of us that are actually, are trying to be aware, trying to be awake, trying to figure stuff out, have concerns, and often run in various directions without a whole lot of scientific basis. And in my, certainly from what I've seen, from anything I've read, and from the people who have run into the station saying, come outside right now and look in the sky, there are chemtrails, that's a plane. So I think that I'm really glad Eric called, because this is one of those persistent worries in our community that I think serve as ultimately a huge distraction. And it is absolutely, it's evidence that we know we're being lied to. We know we can't trust official stories. And so we grasp at straws and we look over here and over there and under that rock for things that are really scary. When in fact, the really scariest thing is in fact this let's just say drastic climate change extinction, looking at the end of our planet because of our actions, whether it's through nuclear holocaust or severe climate change or what have you.
Or a civilization that is a behemoth that can't be budged.
Yes.
Right. And I think this is just another example of people not wanting to take responsibility. If we can just blame it on somebody or something else. Look, they are chemtrailing us. Mm-hmm. It's the classic libertarian approach from my perspective. Libertarians, well, cats are libertarians, really.
Oh, house cats, of course.
Right? House cats think they don't depend upon you at all. And they're in charge.
I think of them more as royalists, but that's another story.
Right. And then try taking away the water bowl. Try taking away water coming through the taps and see what happens to your local libertarian. I mean, cat. Right. Then they recognize, oh, I actually depend upon this whole thing.
Yeah.
But I don't want to take responsibility for it, so I'm going to point the finger over there.
Let's go ahead, and we have a couple more callers. Let's try to squeeze them in. Good morning, Jamila. You are on the air.
Hi, everyone. How are you guys doing today?
Doing okay.
Good. Thank you guys for touching on such an important topic. I just wanted to kind of bring up the idea of, or even just talk and ask Professor an important question that where are we seeing spirituality in the form of addressing climate change? I feel like as humans, we've kind of shifted away from that, where back in the days where specifically also Native American communities, African folks used to all pray for rain, for droughts when happens. And so, and also there's a lot of things and a lot of negativity things that's going on. And so how do we make the connection of spirituality to the environment and also creating this change of how can you make sure that in your own, as you're being, are you, as you're contributing to the climate change, address some of the things that you need to address in order for you to contribute and make sure that we're not using or depleting too much? Because today, we're, as a human, we're consuming a lot, and we think that there's infinite.
So we need to make your question really fast now, just because we're running out of show, so that Guy can answer.
How do we connect spirituality and all the traditional practices that many communities have used before to help the environment into today's talk about climate change? Because
we get your question right now, but we need to speed it up because we don't have much time.
We'll just
let
Guy answer.
Yeah, let's let Guy answer.
Thanks very much, Jamil. I'm really glad you brought up that.
I have three words with respect to how we lived for 2.8 million years of the genus Homo and that are equally applicable today. Anarchism, anarchism, anarchism. Realtors use some ripoff of it all the time. But if you're looking for spirituality, it must be rooted in a place. If you're looking for how you live your lives and how you interact with other people in your lives, it must be rooted in a particular place. Anarchism, anarchism, anarchism.
Works for me.
That's the theme of our show, kind of. So thank you very much.
Well, allow me to say we have just about 3 minutes left. So if people have been listening and taking to heart the fact that we are in a very dire time, as a grief counselor, if someone's having a hard time with this information, and I'm expecting some people are, what do you suggest we actually do at this point? I hate laying heavy information on people and then just saying,
and tell us in 2 minutes.
We'll see you next week.
Don't think about this for the next week, and we'll address it more then.
Right.
Well, I think there are several things people can do. They can spend their time with the ones they love, for starters, and really focus on the small communities, the relatively few people who have influence over our lives and whose lives we have influence over. Actually focus on that instead of being distracted by the next big game, the shopping mall down the street, the bread and circuses that are trotted out by this culture every single second. Put away your digital devices, turn off the television.
Blow it up.
Set aside, yes, exactly. Shoot your television is what I meant to say.
Yeah. And I thought you did.
Spend time with the ones you love. And if you want to go deeper into this material, a colleague and I have developed a workshop that you can find at onlyloveremains.org. Get accustomed to the reality, immerse yourself in that reality, and I think what you will find is that your ability to live is enhanced by the knowledge that the reminder that your life is short, that all of our lives are short, that we're all going to die. We've known this for a long time, and so let's live here now with the ones we're with.
You make that seem so simple.
And yet I know how very difficult it is.
It is, right?
You have many books on the subject.
Guy McPherson, thank you so very much for joining us this morning on Positively Revolting here on KABU, your community radio station.
And you also have another blog called Nature Bats Last.
Yes.
That is also, and it's, you know, you invite people to contribute, which is also great.
So
check that out.
Are there ways of contacting you or following your work?
All of my contact information and all of my work is linked from guymcpherson.com. That's Nature Bats Last.
Excellent. Thank you so much again for joining us this morning on Positively Revolting.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. It's been a wonderful show.
Thanks.
This is it. There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Good morning, you're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, One Land, Many Voices, we hear a talk by Remy Kanazi, a Palestinian-American performance poet and human rights activist who spoke at Portland State University on divestment on school campuses. At 10, it's Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Flashpoints. At 11, Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher hosts a panel discussion with presenters from the Mathematics Education and Society Conference, a biennial international conference being held this week at Portland State University, exploring social, political, cultural, and ethical dimensions of mathematics education. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support for community radio. You are listening to it. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.